Evening all. So, just as John mentioned earlier on, this is the last in this series about the letters to the churches in East Asia. And they're each letters which are designed to challenge those churches in specific ways. This letter is relatively straightforward at face value. JT, can I have verse 1 up, please? Go back to where we were just now. The letters, that's it, thank you. The letters have a consistent style. And as I mentioned before, the clue to what comes in the letter comes from the qualities of God that are mentioned in the opening paragraph or the opening verse. And in this case, these are the words of the Amen, so be it. This is how it's meant to be. The faithful and true ruler, faithful and true witness, the ruler of God's creation. So what follows has to be phrased, has to be understood and read in the context of those qualities of God are the things that we're about to be challenged on. So this is how it's meant to be, faithful and a true witness. Now, on to the next passage, please, JT. And this is the uncomfortable part. I know your deeds, that you're neither cold nor hot, and I wish you were either one or the other. Now that is truly uncomfortable reading. And we could stop there really, because we know what it is God's saying to us. If we're really honest, we know what it is God's saying to us. If we have a relationship that lacks passion, that relationship will fail. If we take each other for granted, then our relationships will fail. If we take our role for granted, then that role will not produce goods. So God is challenging us. He's saying to the church there, and he's saying to us, I know your deeds and they're neither hot nor cold. I wish they were either one or the other. Now it's quite interesting that he wishes they were one or the other. From my context, I'd think, well, maybe he'd wish that they were one, which was hot. He'd want us to be on fire. But he's saying, I just wish you'd be one or the other. And it's okay to be cold. It's okay to actually be out there somewhere, because there's no pretense in out there. The pretense piece comes when you sit in the middle and say, I am this. But in reality, you act like that. Scroll forward. So because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm about to spit you out. Now lukewarm, I looked in the thesaurus at lukewarm and tepid, and ran through a series of words as you do, and I got to the word grey. I looked in the mirror and thought, oh no. The answer obviously is in Grecian 2000, because it's all about grey. But this reality, this challenge is that we're just not committed in the way that we should be. Now what follows now, I think, is the most countercultural challenge that comes in any of these seven letters. And Jakey, can you scroll forward? Because I think this is at the heart of it. You say, I am rich, I've acquired wealth, and I do not need a thing. But you don't realize that you're wretched, pitiful, poor, blind, and naked. Now I was brought up in the baby boomer generation. My parents were wartime children. My parents don't have faith, didn't have faith and don't have faith. And my parents brought me up to believe that to work hard is what it's all about, to earn well is what it's all about, to provide for my family. To have material possessions is a good thing, because they didn't. And those are the things that should drive me. They should be my fundamental drivers. And it's not about being wicked. They knew the difference between good and evil, and they still do. But everything about my upbringing was about being successful, being striving for worldly success. And in that respect, I didn't do bad. So when I read this, I feel really uncomfortable about it to start with. But I think the key for this passage is not the fact that you've acquired wealth or that you're rich. Because the reality is each one of us, in worldly terms, sitting here tonight is rich. Now, whether you perceive yourself that way or otherwise, if you take yourself in world terms, with a roof over our heads, we don't want for food in the way that starving people do. We don't want for clean water as starving people do. We're wealthy people. But it's the reality of saying, and I do not need a thing. It's the reality which says, it's me, and I can... Crazy frog. Extraordinary. It's the reality which says, I don't need anything. The world will have a say, if you are successful, you don't need anything more than success. You don't need faith. You don't need God. There's the challenge here. And how does he describe that? He says that the reality of that is that you are pitiful, wretched, poor, blind, and naked. Now, if you think of some of the people that are most wealthy that you know, and you look at that description, it's quite hard to put that description against that person. Richard Branson. Pitiful. Well, sometimes a fairly bad beard and hairdo, but apart from that, wretched, probably not. It's a bit rough. Poor, definitely not. Blind, definitely not. And naked, definitely not. But God sees them differently. So what is the blindness? What is the nakedness? And there's the challenge for us, really, because God's trying to show us something much, much deeper than the reality of our world as it stands. And in that way, he's saying to us, that's why we're lukewarm, because we can't see the reality of the glory that sits there just the other side of the door that he stands at. So to truly understand that, I think we need to go take this whole thing, these whole letters, back into context and put them in the context of Revelation 2. Because I think God's saying to us something much, much bigger than, guys, don't be taken in by what you own. Don't get comfortable in what you own. I think it's way, way bigger than that. So if we go back through our seven letters, our first letter to Ephesus, remember... and turn back to your first love. The letter to Smyrna. Persevere in the face of inevitable challenge. Pergamum, be authentic as a Christian. Thyatira, don't be unduly tolerant at the cost of your faith. Sardis, live and work in the Spirit. Philadelphia, recognize and embrace that you're called to lead. And Laodicea here, remembering at the start of this letter to Laodicea, it's the Amen. The letter to Laodicea is go for it. So at the start of Revelation, which is this picture of glory, this picture of heaven, this painting of heaven that's created by John, we start with these seven letters, which are about qualities that we have to understand. That we have to understand personally, and we have to understand as church. Turn back to love. Persevere in the face of inevitable challenge. Be authentic as a Christian. Don't be unduly tolerant for the cost of your faith. Live and work in the Spirit. Recognize and embrace that you're called to lead. And go for it. That is intended to equip us for our purpose. Those seven qualities are intended to equip us for our purpose. But we have to see more than that. We have to see, well, what is it that allows John and God to say to us, forget about your wealth because There's something way, way more that you just can't get yet. And I think what he does then is we need to look at this in the context of Revelation as a whole. What happens next in Revelation after the seventh letter is this. After this, I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven. And a voice I had first heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this." The voice I first heard, what must take place after these seven things. It's not what may take place, it's what must take place. There are seven qualities which we comply with, which we strive for. And then John says, and this is what comes next. And what comes next in worldly terms is unbelievable. And this is where I think he can talk about riches and say you're just missing the point here. Because the pattern of Revelation is this. We have our letters, the seven letters. Then there's a revelation of the throne of God. And it's just a glorious painting of the throne of God. Then there's a series of sections which are all in sevens. The seven seals are opened. Seven trumpets sound. Seven spiritual figures appear. Seven bowls appear. And then there's judgment. And that lot together is the apocalypse. So it's this whole concept of judgment. But then what happens? Then we get to glory. JT, can you put up that 21... 1 to 7, please. And we'll just read this through. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who is seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true." He said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of the water of life." And these words then resonate. He who overcomes, it's every letter that's written, every one of those seven letters finishes with "he who overcomes this will." He who overcomes will inherit all of this. And I will be his God, and he will be my son. That's what John's trying to say to us in these letters. John's trying to say to us, look, don't be lukewarm because of what you've got here. Because the reality of what your promise is this. God says to us, "I will be your God and you will be my son." Now, if we can truly grasp the fullness of that. And working your way through Revelation quickly is hard work. It really is hard work. But he's trying to paint to us. We can't get our head around the reality of what heaven is. The concept, fine, but the reality we can't get our head around because it's just not big enough. We don't have words to describe it. We experience things that we can't explain. And heaven, let's just face it, isn't something which is out there for a time when we die. Because there are times when heaven and earth coincide now, when we're alive. Heaven is a thing for now. And that's why we strive to be passionate and not to be lukewarm. That's why we strive not to be tepid, not to be grey. Because heaven is changing someone's suffering into someone's hope. That's our call. That's the driver. That's our calling. That's what we're here for. That's what we're made for. So in this letter, in this last letter, let's see the letter in its own right, and let's be challenged about our lukewarmness. And that's not to say that each one of us is lukewarm, far from it. I suspect the reality is that each one of us had times when we're lukewarm and times when we're highly passionate about it, like we are about everything else. But let's see it in its entirety. Let's see these seven letters in their entirety. They paint this fantastic picture for us. There are qualities that we strive for, and if we strive for the qualities, then what must follow is the glory of Revelation, is the glory of heaven. And it's there. It's not in a distance. It's not, as I say, it's not in the years between now and when you die. It's there right now. And my experience is the more passionate you are, the more clarity you can see of heaven, the more that revelation becomes clear to you. This letter finishes. To him who overcomes, I will give the right to sit with me on my throne, just as I overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. What a promise. We can dine with Jesus. We just need to be passionate. Amen.